Okay, they knew Luke. The man that I'm going to talk about today, his name is Johann Staupitz. Staupitz. Johann Staupitz is a man, I suppose, for whom I feel sorrier than anybody else that was involved in the Lutheran Reformation. Staupitz was the man who was the head of the Augustinian order in Germany when Luther became an Augustinian monk. He was the man who looked out for Luther and lived to regret it. Quite literally, lived to regret it. Well, the first contact was this way. Luther entered the Augustinian monastery in Erfurt, Germany, on July 17th, 1505, carrying with him a copy of Virgil's poetry, Plautus's plays, and a mandolin. Now, Luther had recently completed his Master of Arts degree, which completed his liberal arts educational program. And he supposedly was now beginning to study to be a lawyer. He was going now to professional school, which was a perfectly standard curricular program. He decided for some reason or other to leave his professional studies and become a monk, and he walks into the monastery unannounced in Erfurt, where he was attending the University of Erfurt, and he's carrying these two books and a mandolin. If he were living today and doing that, I suppose it would be something like if he had an anthology of the world's great literature, 2 years' worth of Playboy magazine, and a guitar. That would be an electric guitar, probably. That would be about the equivalent. It would tell you something about the sort of person that Martin Luther was at that time. The reason why I say that is because Virgil, through the Middle Ages, was really the popular educator of the Western world. Virgil's Aeneid was the textbook of the Western world for better than 1,000 years. They used it for everything. They used it for how to write. They used it for stylistic purposes. They used it to teach geography. They used it, strangely enough, to teach theology. Use it for all sorts of purposes. So it was kind of a universal textbook. The plays of Plautus. Plautus and Terence were the two great writers of comedy, the golden age of Rome. I don't know whose plays were dirtier. I'm sure that, if you had a collection of Plautus's plays, that was typical college boy possession, just like Playboy magazine is typical college boy possession today, and for the same purpose. Shows you, the typical college guy secular mentality that Luther had when he entered the Augustinian monastery. I realize that shatters a lot of beliefs, because especially us Lutherans, we have been led up we've been raised with a certain image about Martin Luther. We can see him practically crawling in on his knees to that monastery, and it really wasn't that way at all. As far as what we have tended to do is to make an idealistic neurotic out of Martin Luther, and he was far from that kind of a person. And John Osborne didn't help any with his Luther, where he made him even worse. And so, consequently, I think during this week you're going to see a somewhat different Luther than the one you have usually heard, and I will do my best to kind of show you Luther through the eyes of other people that knew him well or not so well. But anyway, first one is Staupitz. Luther, let me say a little bit before I carry on with Staupitz. Let me say a little bit about education in Luther's day. The standard higher education was to work for the baccalaureate degree and then work for the master's degree in liberal studies. And there were several directions one could go. But most people took a classical literature kind of curriculum, which also involved becoming quite well-versed in classical Latin, because most of the studies were Latin studies and Latin classics. But after one completed the master degree, one was then considered to be a master of the liberal studies. And that's why it was called a master's degree. It was the last degree. You were now a master. You'd mastered the knowledge of mankind. This now was the background for whatever professionally you were going to do. Now, it was the case also at universities. Universities weren't any different then than they are now. And so it was a standard procedure that when you got the baccalaureate degree and when your university invited you to continue for your master's degree, you got subsidized by the university. You also were expected to function sort of like a graduate assistant. So, you know, you did some teaching, at least to a limited extent. All right, now when you got your master's degree and you began working for a professional degree, whether it be JD or MD or THD, you know, or which professional degree you were working for, you know, and they were all doctorates, you were expected to teach undergraduates working for their baccalaureate degree. As a matter of fact, you could not be a doctoral student at the university without doing that. And when you became a student working for the doctorate, you committed yourself to that university as its employee. And this is why when Luther was teaching at Wittenberg, and I'll talk about that a bit later, when Luther was teaching at Wittenberg, he wrote to the University of Erfurt, where he still technically was enrolled as a candidate for the doctorate. He wrote to them and asked them whether he could teach at Wittenberg and get the doctorate from Erfurt, and they wrote back and said, "You can't." Well, he did. It shows you how much political clout was operative there with the elector whose little pet the University of Wittenberg was. But this was the standard kind of procedure, and so what had happened now was, at the time when Luther entered the monastery, Luther had begun summer studies for the degree in jurisprudence, a doctoral degree in jurisprudence to become a lawyer. And he was committed for at least 3 years, apart from anything else, to be teaching undergraduates at the University of Erfurt. You know, so he chucked his job and ran. And it wasn't, you know, that he suddenly had a religious conversion, you know, and he saw the light and so on. But he ran out on his job. And it's amazing that the University of Erfurt was as tolerant with him as they were in later years. Well, at any rate, he comes into the Augustinian monastery, and very short time after this, the vicar general of the German Augustinian congregation, very distinguished sounding title, this man right here, heard about him and became quite interested in him. Well, it wasn't every day that the Augustinians picked up somebody with this good an education. Most of the people that they got were kids that could barely read and write. The Augustinians weren't the most popular order because they were very strict. They were called the black monks because they wore black outfits. And, you know, it gets hot in Germany in the summertime. Imagine wandering around here in a black wool gown and cowl, you know, yay thick. A little rough on the constitution. They fasted a lot and they prayed a lot. They were one of the few orders that kept all of the hours. And, you know, the hours don't end at 9 p.m. and start again at 8 a.m. They run through the night. So they got up through the night to observe every 3 hours the canonical hours of the church, either in chanting or praying or both, or scripture reading. And so it was a difficult life. They were an order that was an ascetic order. In other words, part of the rule of Augustine was to suppress the body. They were in competition for young men with the Dominicans, and the Dominicans believed that God had given this world to his people for their joy, and they drank accordingly. Well, they were both teaching orders. But the Dominicans were all chubby. I'm going to talk to you about one of them tomorrow. I'm sure you'll know which one. And he was a very chubby one. But it was typical of the Dominicans that they were well-fed and happy. They had large farms and other sorts of things so that they drank fresh milk and ate good meat and vegetables and so on. And they lived well. I mean, they weren't gluttons or anything like that, but they didn't believe in torturing themselves. Well, the Augustinians were committed to a Stoic life of abstinence. So here you got this kid walking in with Plautus under his arm and his mandolin under the other arm, and he says, "Where do I join up?" Well, it's not surprising, you know, that they began to think wonders of what they had. At the same time, the Augustinian order was probably the most powerful monastic order in Europe at the time. It turned out the best scholars. The head of the Augustinian order in Rome was the most respected man in the church. And it certainly is understandable when you remember that this is the time of the Renaissance popes and the guys who were living it up when they weren't out trying to win some more real estate by war, you know, or giving Michelangelo a hard time, or driving Raphael to an early grave. You know, they were really living it up, and nobody respected them. Everybody was afraid of them, but nobody respected them. And so the head of the Augustinian order was, he was one of the most respected church leaders in Christendom because he and his monks practiced abstinence and led very ascetic lives. Okay, Staupitz had been born at a little town called Mutterwitz, which was near Leipzig in Saxony. So he was a Saxon, as was Luther. We don't know exactly when he was born. It was a few years before 1460, and he was approximately about 25 years older than Luther was. He came from a very old and respected Saxon family, and he himself had had a distinguished academic career. He had studied at Leipzig University, which was one of the leading universities of Europe at the time. He had graduated from there in 1485 and then joined bachelor's degree and then joined the Augustinian order in Munich. That order sent him in 1497 to Tübingen University, which was one of the new young universities that was doing very great innovative kind of work. Leipzig was one of the old universities. But Tübingen was one of the new universities, and it had as its most distinguished member of the faculty a man named Gabriel Biel, B-I-E-L, about whom we've done altogether too little research, particularly the influence of Biel's thought on Martin Luther's thought. Gabriel Biel had studied under William of Ockham at Oxford University, and William of Ockham was the leading logician of the day. Gabriel Biel was a German humanist. And the humanists, you all know, the most famous humanist today of that time was a man named Erasmus, who was from Rotterdam, Holland. Gabriel Biel was German. I'll talk and mention on Thursday another humanist named Reuchlin. The elector tried to get Reuchlin, who was also a German, to be the big name at his new university at Wittenberg, and Reuchlin said, I'm up to here in commitments, I just can't do it. I'll tell you what I'll do, I got a nephew who's a real bright kid, I'll send him. And I'll talk about the nephew on Thursday. You all know who he is. Oh, you don't know, you know who he is. Okay. Well, anyway, humanism was the new thing. Humanism was the soul of the Renaissance. The first humanists were the Italian humanists. They concerned themselves with man. For 1,000 years, everybody had been talking about God. Now all of a sudden they're talking about man. What is man's role in life? What can he do? What are the limits to his capacity? And he really didn't know of many. And so all of a sudden we have a human-centered universe, and this is why they were called humanists. And what they were concerned with was, what can man do? What dignity does man have? And Baal was one of the greats. And so the order had sent Staupitz to study under Baal at Tübingen University. In 1498, he became the prior of the Augustinian order at Tübingen. In 1500, he received his Doctor of Theology degree from Tübingen University. Now, bear in mind now that he's more than 40 years old when he gets his Doctor of Theology degree. So while he had a distinguished degree, you know, he's no boy genius. Now, the standard age for someone in a monastic order, and bear in mind that someone in a monastic order is just like a single that Joanne was talking about before, you know, you haven't got wife and kids to be concerned about. The order picks up the tab, you can study full time and so on. So there are no distractions or anything else for pursuing your academic career. And so usually one would have gotten a doctorate in theology degree probably around age 30, 32. So he's a little over 40 when he gets a doctorate in theology. Now, it's perfectly possible, you know, that he had gone through the liberal arts curricular program for a certain number of years and maybe lost a few years in the process. But anyway, regardless, he is a fairly old doctor when he gets his doctorate. Now, make a couple comments about the theological degrees. There were two professional degrees in the theology program. The theology program had its master's degree and its doctor's degree, which came after the liberal arts master's degree. So you got two masters. You got the Master of Arts degree, and then you got the Master of Sacred Theology degree, except that they usually called it the Master of Sentences degree. Because about four centuries before, a guy named Peter Lombard had put together a very helpful compendium of quotations of the fathers on all kinds of topics, all kinds of theological topics. So in your master's program, your textbook was the Book of Sentences of Peter Lombard, and you studied that. When you got your master's degree, this meant that you were now qualified to comment independently on the Book of Sentences. And you didn't just simply have to say, well, so-and-so says this about this, and so-and-so says this about this. You were now considered competent to say, I think such and such about what this person said. But you were not competent to lecture independently on Scripture. You were not competent to do that until you got your doctorate in theology. When you got your doctorate in theology, you were considered competent now to function autonomously in interpreting the Bible. Now, most people didn't. Luther didn't either. I mean, Luther's early lectures after he got his Ph.D. are all extant, and just loaded with quotations, you know, from grad school. The typical grad school lectures, you know, where he got all his grad school notes out, and he's swiping this and he's swiping that, you know, as he's lecturing to the undergraduates at Wittenberg University. He's using all the stuff that he was taught, just like most everybody else did when they started out teaching if they got their degree. And I think he did that for a somewhat shorter time than most people do. Usually we say in grad school that when you get a doctorate, you teach your doctor's dissertation for the next 5 years in one form or another before you outgrow it. But, you know, so he did also in some of his early lectures. One of the sets happens to be the Book of Romans, and I personally think that this is one of the limitations of his commentary in the Book of Romans, that he's still under the influence of grad school and he's running independent. And all you've got to do is compare that, for instance, with his commentary on Galatians, you know, which is the village book for the summer. And you see a man that is moving about freely, thinking his own thoughts, and it's a great book. Whereas the Book of Romans is kind of stiff and stilted, and he's still he's still remembering what he was taught at grad school. And he doesn't feel at home with what he's doing that much. All right. Well, at any rate, he was then transferred to Munich as the prior of the order at Munich, and the order at Munich was the biggest monastery that they had in Germany. He was, in 1503, he was elected vicar general of all of the German Augustinian monasteries, so apparently he was rather good at administration. Now, we tend not to, you know, to think that monasteries need administrators, business managers, and things of that sort. You know, but they do. They did, and they do. You get a very shortly get a different slant on Luther, because Luther, in short order, became his assistant. And Luther was a good administrator. In those so-called trauma years when he didn't know what to believe, you know, the guy was an administrator, and he was running half a dozen monasteries. Which, you know, gives you a little pause for thought about, you know, whether the traditional image of Luther is that accurate that we've grown up with. All right. Well, in 1504, the Elector of Saxony, who was an extreme, probably the most powerful man in Europe at the time, he brought him to Wittenberg. He says, "You will go to Wittenberg." He didn't say, "Would you like to go?" He simply told him to go to Wittenberg, because the Elector was starting a new university in his favorite little town, Wittenberg, and he wanted Staupitz to head up the School of Theological Studies, including undergraduate theological and philosophical studies, because Staupitz had studied at Tübingen University, which was a very new and modern university. And the Elector wanted a top university right from the start. He wanted the best men, the best curriculum, and so he brought Staupitz in because Staupitz had the right background for what he wanted. When he went there, he revised the constitution of all of the German monasteries, and there were about 13 of them about around Germany, to make them more strict, which no doubt endeared him to all the brothers. He also wrote a book which was strongly Neoplatonic called Amor Dei, Love of God. Fortunately, it no longer exists. All right, back to Martin Luther. Since Luther had a Master of Liberal Arts degree, Staupitz gave instruction that he should study for the priesthood. You know, he had enough dumb priests around. Here's a kid that had a good education. Let's make a priest out of him, so at least we got one intelligent priest. He left instructions that he was to study for the priesthood and that he should begin to study and prepare himself for a career as a professor of theology. And 2 years later, 1507, Luther became a priest. This is 2 years after he entered the monastery. By the way, last week was 471st anniversary of Luther entering the Augustinian order, wasn't it? July 17th. Okay, we'll celebrate in some kind of form. Up to this time, Luther had exhibited no theological problems. And it was after he became a priest that he began to express theological difficulties, and express them to Staupitz. All right, in 1508, Staupitz had him transferred to the monastery at Wittenberg from the monastery at Erfurt, and it's not a long distance, but he had him transferred there. Since he had a liberal arts degree, he was competent to teach philosophy. In fact, most of his curriculum had been Aristotelian philosophy. And so at Wittenberg, he began a teaching career by teaching philosophy and the ethics of Aristotle. Rather interesting that Luther is oftentimes, you know, quoted as being very strongly anti-philosophy. And one of the remarks of Luther that I think is best left relatively unknown was, Well, when he was at an age to know better, he said he thought that Aristotle's ethics ought to be required of all students. And he thought that Aristotle's ethics was almost as good as the Bible. I don't happen to agree with him, and so I'm glad that it's sort of been forgotten. But what hasn't been forgotten was a lot of negative remarks that Luther made about depending on Plato and Aristotle to teach you theology. Okay, well, he begins to teach philosophy and Aristotelian ethics. Staupitz is teaching biblical exegesis, and he's dean of the theology faculty. Now, one of the interesting things about that faculty, and theology and philosophy were together in that one faculty, one of the interesting things about that faculty was Staupitz deliberately created a mixed theology faculty there. He got in people who were humanists. He got in people who, today I suppose we would call Thomists, you know, who were students of Thomas Aquinas. He brought in people who were Augustinians, you know, who were followers of St. Augustine. And what he tried to do was to give the students a mix. Guys that were committed to this position, guys that were committed to that position. The leader of the conservative group, and that was the group that had studied Thomistic theology. The leader of that group was Karl Stutt, the guy who went nuts, you know, went crazy all over the place when Luther was at the Wartburg. But he was the leader of the Thomistic group on the faculty. The humanists seem not to have been very good or made much of an impression, because the guys who really represented in the early years of Wittenberg University, the guys who really represented the humanistic viewpoints and went over like gangbusters with the students, were Luther and Melanchthon. Neither of whom technically, well, Melanchthon was a layman who, you know, who picked up theology on his own. His total education was liberal studies. And he came there, well, he was, when he came to the university, well, I shouldn't be talking about that today because I'm going to talk about him later on, but all right, when he came to Wittenberg University, he's about the only guy in the faculty that could read Greek. And not just New Testament Greek, he read classical Greek fluently. So all the boys were learning from him. And he was 21 years old. A little smarty pants. And, I'll talk about him later on in the week. Okay. So now Staupitz and Luther are in the same monastery. And this is the first time they're together in the same monastery. They live, I don't know whether you any of you have any background of experience with, for instance, a Jesuit university in the United States. You know, any of the Jesuit brothers who are teaching on the faculty, they live in the house, in the monastic house. And they all live together and they have their house life. And, you know, as well as being in the classroom, you know, they don't have their private residences and so on, but they live in a house. And so in a house of studies. And so also, that's the way it was at Wittenberg. It's the way it was at Leipzig. Any Dominicans that were teaching at a university, they lived together in the Dominican house. If there were any Augustinians that were teaching at the university, they all lived together in the Augustinian house. If any Benedictines were teaching, they all lived together in the Benedictine house, which was part of the university campus. Okay, so they were there together, and Staupitz was dean of Luther's faculty. He was the department chairman, and he was also the prior of that house, and he was the vicar general of all of the German monasteries. So he was an extremely influential man. From 1508, the years 1508 and 1509, the two saw one another every day at meals. And Luther apparently was loaded with questions that he would bring up to ask Staupitz at meals. Luther's reflection on Staupitz in those early years was, and this is a quote, "He was a firm but kindly ruler." Luther had two problems. The first problem was, what good is penance? How can penance in any way, shape, or form atone for sin? You know, you go to confession, you confess your sins, your confessor tells you to do penance, you do this, that, and the other thing. What good does that do? How can that atone for sin? Kind of a renegade in his thinker, you know, not a not a quiet, obedient son of the church who does what he's told. The second question was, how is it possible to reconcile God's foreknowledge with man's free will? How can God foreknow the things are going to happen the way they're going to happen? And how can we be free? This latter problem was one that was a problem that was exercising the humanists, particularly those who came out of the Occamite tradition, and so it's understandable that it bothered Luther. Staupitz was able to help Luther on the first question about penance, but he wasn't able to help him on the second one, and he finally solved it on his own, probably around 1514, 1515, and from that time on, he got everything straightened out. So anyway, we have from about 1507 to about, say, roughly 1515, a period of 8 years where Luther's trying to sort out, and where he's confused on this and he's confused on that, and finally everything gets clear theologically and philosophically, because the free will question is a philosophic question. Finally, he figures things out, it all comes clear, it all makes sense to him, you know, and then we're ready for the Reformation. Okay. What Staupitz said to him about penance was, number one, don't exaggerate how important your sins are. Your sins aren't any bigger or any worse than anybody else's are, so don't exaggerate them. Think on the wounds of Christ. That's a very famous remark attributed to Staupitz. Think on the wounds of Christ. And he said, penitence arises from a love of God. It doesn't create a love of God. You got the cart before the horse. The reason why sins are taken care of, you know, is not by the penance you're doing, but by the love of God that leads to your doing the penance. And then Luther understood, had the thing right, and he began to understand that this isn't a work righteous kind of thing. Now, he also concluded that if it's the love of God that is important here, then we really don't need the acts of penitence. Okay. He once asked Staupitz, how can God both be righteous and loving? Or how can God both be just and merciful is sort of another way of putting it. And Staupitz said, I don't know. I just believe it. In 1542, Luther said to a friend of his that this 8 years where he was trying to sort everything out and understand it, great deal of theological confusion, he said, if it had not been for the help of Dr. Staupitz, I would have been submerged in a sea of doubt and long since been in hell. Well, here's Luther teaching at Wittenberg University. He supposedly is still enrolled at Erfurt University working on his doctorate. He's supposed to be teaching there, and the University of Erfurt sends word down, send the kid back up here to Erfurt to finish his degree program. And they had a little chat with the Elector of Saxony, and it was arranged that Luther would satisfy his teaching requirements at Wittenberg University, and he would commute to Erfurt, do whatever was necessary to complete his Doctor of Theology studies. And he finally did complete his doctorate in theology. But Erfurt didn't have him to teach. He never taught at Erfurt. So they got done out of him, and they didn't like it one bit. I suspect in a few years they were very happy they didn't have him. And the more he got in trouble, the gladder they were, and they hoped nobody noticed that they had given him a degree. But at any rate, to start with here, they weren't too happy, but, you know, who's going to say no to the emperor or to the elector? And so consequently, special arrangements were made for him. Okay, as a result of his concern to improve the purity and discipline of Augustinian monasteries, Staupitz recommended that all of the 13 monasteries in Saxony, in the Thuringia area, become one large association. Well, there were 10 liberal monasteries and 3 conservative monasteries. Guess what? They weren't too happy about that idea. You know, it's hard to understand why they would be, but you know, they didn't like that one bit. And guess who protested to the head of the order in Rome? The 3 conservative monasteries. So as a result, they got together with one another and they said, we got to send a man to Rome to plead our case to the head of the order. This Staupitz is going nuts. So they picked out their man. He couldn't go alone. The order didn't permit a member of the order to travel alone. And he had to have somebody travel with him. Guess who got assigned to go with him to Rome? Martin Luther, Staupitz's man. A little politics there. And this was the only long trip that Luther ever made in his whole life. Over the Alps, down into central Italy to Rome. A real hick. You know, he went in, in his own words too, he went around, gawked at all the tall churches, and he went to all the churches in Rome. He went everywhere. Visited the catacombs, went this place, went that place. Very much in awe of everything Roman. And that's how he happened to get to Rome. He didn't talk to anybody about anything. He was the companion. Okay, so as a result of opposition from the conservative monks, Staupitz wasn't able to bring them into a confederation. And in 1512, he rescinded his order. But the most conservative group in Germany was the monastic group at Erfurt University, the one that Luther had joined. And from this time on, the monks at Erfurt just plain hated Staupitz's guts. In 1511, Luther, who had been doing some studying at the University of Erfurt, asked permission to go back down to Wittenberg and do some more teaching. And he went there, and when he was down there, he was sort of isolated by the monks because, you know, he worked for the administrator. You know, he was in administration now. He was not one of the boys. You know, he had administration involvement. In 1512, Staupitz used his connections to get Luther selected as sub-prior at Wittenberg, as the number 2 man of the order at Wittenberg, and had him put in charge of the training of the theological novices. So he ran the little institutional program for the training of the new monks. He suggested that he complete his studies for the theological doctorate, and Luther stalled all he could. The reason why he stalled was he could see the handwriting on the wall. And one of the things that he could see in the handwriting on the wall was that if he got his doctorate, Staupitz would see to it that he then would become sort of like dean of the monastery church, which was also the castle church and the biggest church in town. And that would mean that he'd have to do a lot of preaching. And Luther had stage fright. You wouldn't believe that, would you? Scared stiff to preach. You know, so scared that his butterflies had butterflies. You know, he about died. Well, no, he didn't later on, you know, but in the early, he was scared stiff to preach. And he sent a message to Staupitz wherein he listed 15 real reasons why he was totally unfit to study for the theological doctorate. And Staupitz kind of dismissed them, and Luther came to see him and said, if I have to preach regularly, I will be dead in 3 months. And the response which Staupitz gave to him, well, let me read Luther's words on this later on, many years later. On one occasion when I was sitting under the pear tree, a famous pear tree in the monastery there, which still stands today in the middle of my yard. By the way, when the Lutheran Church began to get established, the elector gave Luther the monastery at Wittenberg for his private residence. And you know, his He was entertaining so many people all the time that he needed a monastery to house them all. And he needed a kitchen that big to feed them all. His wife, you know, constantly complained that they were going to die in a poor farm because he was always, you know, there were 101 clergymen freeloading off of him all the time. And, well, at any rate, that's why he said it still stands today in the middle of my yard, but it was monastery at that time. Staupitz, my prayer, said to me, Master, you should work for a doctorate. It will give you something to do. When he approached me again under the same pear tree upon the same matter, I showed myself quite reluctant and I presented my arguments, most of all the fact that strength would fail me and I would not live long. Staupitz responded, Why, didn't you know God is doing great things these days? He needs many wise and intelligent men to assist him. If you should die, you can become his advisor. So it kind of shows you a little different side on this guy. Okay, in October 1512, Luther had the Doctor of Theology degree, and Staupitz used his influence with the elector to pay the graduation fees. So he put the bite on the elector to pay the fees for the graduation. All right, now, Staupitz resigned his position as prior at Wittenberg in favor of Luther, and he moved to South Germany, to Munich, in charge of Munich, Nuremberg, and Salzburg. Luther now was in charge of the Faculty of Theology at Wittenberg University, and he was the chapel speaker, and then 2 years later he was asked also to be the preacher for the townspeople. Now, one of the reasons why Staupitz had such great influence on the elector was he traveled around a great deal as a result of his responsibility as vicar general. And one of the things that he did as he traveled around was he would pick up relics for the elector. You know, the elector was famous for his big collection of relics. And Staupitz would bring him a relic back every time he'd been on a trip, and so he had a special in with the elector. Okay. In 1515, Staupitz saw to it that Luther was elected district vicar, in charge of 11 monasteries, 3 fish ponds, several forests and farms. So now we have, in 1515, Luther the administrator. And apparently very good at it. He got along well with his fellow monks, and he was extremely busy with administration and with teaching. And he began to complain that he was so busy he didn't have time to do his daily offices, you know, every 3 hours or so to read his prayers and sections of the Psalms. Okay, so you all know about the 95 Theses bit. As a result of the publishing of the 95 Theses, that sales of indulgences fell off. This was a great big business, you know, it's like a state running a lottery. The promoters got alarmed, they appealed to Rome. They drummed up a heresy accusation to shut him up, and you know, because he was hurting sales, and he was summoned to the head of the Augustinian order, was approached informally by the Pope to have Luther brought to Rome to be examined by his brothers at Rome. Staupitz used his influence with the elector, and it got headed off and stalled off, and instead he was to be examined in Germany. And so the examination place was changed from Rome to Augsburg in 1518. Now, Staupitz was very upset. Now, he was a typical administrator and had been an administrator for many years. One of the basic characteristics of a good administrator is you do everything you can to see to it that the boat doesn't get rocked. You know, and you try to prevent it as much as you can. You're a stabilizer. And so Staupitz did. He was very much alarmed at the hornet's nest that had been stirred up by Luther, and he was doubly alarmed by the size of the response, both ecclesiastical and political, to what he had done. And so he approached Luther and suggested that the two of them go into retreat at Salzburg. In other words, we'll just hole up for a few years at Salzburg. Salzburg seems to be one of his Staupitz's favorite places to be. So he suggested to Luther, let's just go into retreat and disappear for a while until it cools off. Well, they weren't allowed to do that, and Cardinal Cajetan, about whom I'll tell you in a couple of days, who was an Italian theologian as well as an extremely capable diplomat, was sent to Germany to settle the problem any way he saw fit, and to get the indulgence business going once again. He invited Luther to come and see him privately at Augsburg. Luther was advised by Staupitz and others to get a letter of safe conduct because people had gotten those kind of invitations before and not come back. Instead, he got a number of letters to the mayors of various towns that he would pass through asking that he be extended courtesies. There wasn't a great deal of security in that. Everybody told Luther, stay put right where you are, don't even leave town. But he decided to go to Augsburg anyway, and he set out hitchhiking all by himself. And I get riding in ox carts and all kinds of ways. In his first interview with Cajetan, he was very upset. There was no dialogue at all. Cajetan simply told him he was in the wrong. He was to sign a paper saying that he was wrong in what he was done, in what he had written and what he had done, and that was it. That would end the matter. Everything would be okay. Luther asked whether he could have a hearing, and he was told no. He said, can I have some time to think this over? And Cajetan said yes. Luther returned to the monastery in Augsburg, and Staupitz was there. And of course, he was happy to see Staupitz. Staupitz went with him on his second interview. At this interview, Cajetan was much friendlier. They talked back and forth, and it seemed like they were going to get the whole business settled. In fact, they came very close to getting the whole business settled. There had been no reformation. Luther, it looked so good that Staupitz left. Luther came to the third interview. Cajetan was surrounded by his whole court. He began to argue with Luther. Luther made the mistake, which is typical of a theology prophet at a university. He trapped Cajetan into defending a heretical position and then pointed it out to him. And, you know, and there Cajetan is surrounded by his whole retinue, and he comes from a noble Italian family. He's not about to take this from this cocky young German prof. So he got very angry, and he told him not to come back until he was ready to recant. He then called in Staupitz, read the riot act to Staupitz about this cocky young monk that he had foisted on him, teach this guy better manners, and get his protege under control. Staupitz suggested that it might be wise to have a public disputation on the matter, which, of course, Cajetan wasn't about to do. Staupitz asked him to give him a statement of the heresies that Luther supposedly was guilty of and what he was supposed to recant. And Cajetan said he would provide such a statement. Staupitz came back to the monastery, told Luther what had happened, told Luther he thought that he was in very bad trouble, and it was at that point that he did a rather strange thing. And he didn't do it because he wanted to. He took Luther into a room where the two of them were alone, and he released him from his monastic vows. In other words, he said, you are no longer bound by your monastic vows. You have complete freedom to defend any position you want. Well, on the one hand, you know, it gave Luther freedom that he didn't have before. He didn't have to kiss the cardinal's ring anymore or anything like that, you know. And the order couldn't lean on him to force him into line, you know, or to stick him away in a monastery in the mountains and put him in seclusion where he couldn't contact anybody. At the same time, on the other hand, it got the Augustinians off the hook. He was no longer an Augustinian monk. You know, and there he is. Where's he going to stay tomorrow night? He's no longer a member of the order. So it was a mixed kind of thing. And so Luther now is officially a member of the laity. Well, I take it back. He's still a priest, but he's no longer a monk. Stalpitz said he was leaving. He suggested that Luther also leave. And Luther said, well, will you tell the elector what happened and ask him if he will support me? Well, they both left. Stalpitz did talk to the elector, and the elector did support him. But this was the last that they directly had any associations with one another to Mount Pennington. On the way home, Luther came to Nuremberg, and he bumped into Stalpitz there. Stalpitz, in the meantime, had gotten a copy of the Pope's instructions to Caetan, and it simply had said, this German monk is wrong, silence him, if necessary, burn him, get the indulgence trade going once again. He was furious at the cold-blooded condemnation without trial and the enormity of the charges that had been trumped up, and he began to think about going into retirement. He was resentful toward Luther because of what Luther had, the problems that he had created. In brief, there was a final effort made from Rome to have the order discipline Luther and shut him up. Stalpitz blocked that and refused to do it. He resigned his administrative positions, went to Salzburg. In 1522, he received permission to leave the Augustinians and become a Benedictine. This was approved. He became an abbot in Salzburg, and he died December 28, 1524, a very sad and embittered man. And he told Luther at one time, you are going to destroy the Augustinian order. And he almost did. The Augustinians went from one of the most powerful monastic groups to 300 meaningless monks in about 20 years' time. And the Augustinian order has never amounted to anything since then. And so the first guy who knew Luther was a man who was an administrator, very much an organization man, a faithful son of the church. And his view of Luther is, you know, sort of like what I tried to tell you today. Another John tomorrow, Johann Tetzel.